In our last session on 1 Samuel, we took chapters 16 and 17, but we did not finish chapter 17, which was greatly to be regretted. But we read so far as to include the victory of David over Goliath and the pursuit of the Philistines on the part of the Israelites until they had plundered their tents, it says in verse 53. And in verse 54 it says, "And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent." Now, I read it, but we didn't have time to really discuss this very much in terms of its spiritual implications in our last session, and I said we would do that. I don't want to go too much into detail on it because I succumbed to the temptation to make a whole session, additional session on this chapter. This story is a very rich one. But I just want to give some indication of what I consider to be the spiritual significance of the story. And then we do need to move on and take new material. David, we should begin to understand if we don't already, is in many respects a type of Christ. Very possibly more a type of Christ than any other individual in the Old Testament. Now, when we talk about someone being a type of Christ, it doesn't mean that everything about them resembles Christ. Far from it. Adam is said to be a type of Christ by Paul. He speaks of Adam as a type of Christ in Romans chapter 5, he says he is a type of him that was to come. That is, Adam was a type of Christ. But Adam is mainly remembered for his sin and not for anything good. So how is it that he is a type of Christ? Well, only in this respect, that Adam is the beginner of a new race, and those who come from his race have had to endure the consequences of his moral choices. Likewise, Jesus is the founder of a new race, and those who are part of his race are the beneficiaries of his moral choices and his actions. And in that sense, Adam and Christ are both the founders of of whole humanities, of whole human families, who take their spiritual identity and status from the founder. And in that respect, Adam and Christ stand unique in history as the founders of two human families. Now, in other respects, Adam is not very much like Christ, and yet the Bible identifies him as a type of Christ. So when we say someone's a type of Christ, we mean that some things about their career, some things about their life, resemble something that corresponds to something in Christ's career or his life. And so we find from time to time Isaac is a type of Christ, or Isaiah is a type of Christ. We haven't come to that yet. And others. Joseph may well be a type of Christ. That has been suggested strongly. And we will not try to exhaust the list of possible persons in the Bible who could in some respect be a type of Christ, but probably no one is so much a type of Christ in the Old Testament as is David, so much so that the Messiah in the Old Testament prophets is sometimes referred to as if his name were David. In Ezekiel, chapters 34 and 37, in Jeremiah, I believe, and in Hosea, if I'm not mistaken, the Messiah is referred to by name as David. Now, this is not to suggest that David was literally to be the Messiah's name, but rather that the prophets, not having revealed to them the actual name, gave David as the name because A, the Messiah would be descended from David, and B, David is very much a type of the Messiah. And this is seen to be borne out in the New Testament, where Psalms of David are quoted frequently and attributed to Jesus as if he spoke them. And this is, as you know, the Psalms are the Old Testament book which most frequently is quoted in the New Testament by Christian authors. There's no book of the Old Testament they quote more frequently, and mostly they quote Psalms of David. And when they do, it is not uncommon for the New Testament writers to attribute the words of these Psalms to Jesus himself. We won't look at the examples of that right now, simply because our time would fail us to. But I'm saying that the David of whom we are reading is very much recognized in Scripture as a type of the Messiah, and the Messiah, of course, was later known to be really Jesus, but his resemblance to David is great. Now, I'm just glancing real quickly here to see if I can locate the passage in one of those passages in Ezekiel, which calls him David. Yeah, here we go. Ezekiel 37, if you'd like an example of the Messiah being referred to as David. Ezekiel 37. In verse 24, it says, "David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd, and they shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes." Now, Jesus said, I have sheep that you don't know about. I'm going to get them also. Then there will be one shepherd and one flock, meaning himself and his sheep. Here, using language taken from Ezekiel, but applying to himself what was said of David in Ezekiel. Or actually, it was said of Christ, but David was the name used for him because David is a firm type of Christ. Likewise, in Ezekiel 34, verse 23, it says, I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd. Now, this again is a reference to Christ in the context. I can't prove that to you at this point. If you have skepticism about it, which you're entitled to have until it's demonstrated, but if you would look at that more carefully later on, I think you'd find that that is the case. Also, Hosea, in chapter 3 and verse 5, refers to the Messiah and apparently calls him David. It says in verse 4 and 5 of Hosea 3, for the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince. I take this to be what we call the intertestamental period. After the Babylonian captivity, there was 400 years, during which time the Jews had no king of their own race. And then came Jesus at the end of that period. Well, the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return, seek the Lord their God and David their king, and fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Now, David, their king, here, I think most would agree, is a reference to the Messiah. So we won't take the time to look at other cases. Jeremiah 30 and verse 9 is another instance of this. The point I'm trying to make is that the Old Testament prophets and the New Testament writers all take it for granted that David is very much a type of Christ. And I think he is a type of Christ in more respects than some others are, certainly more respects than Adam is. Joseph is very much... very much appears to be a type of Christ. Maybe not as much as David, however. Now, in the contest between David and Goliath, which every Sunday school child is acquainted with, there is, I think, a spiritual significance that many, even adult Christians, have never contemplated and are not acquainted with. And that is that we have in the conflict between David and Goliath a standoff between two, not just individuals, but two kingdoms. Because the fall of Goliath was not just a personal defeat for him. And had David fallen, it would not just be his own personal defeat. You remember the challenge that the Philistines made, and the agreement, which apparently the Jews accepted by accepting the challenge, was this, that if you Israelites conquer our champion, then our nation will be subservient to you, will be your servants. But if our champion conquers your champion, then your nation will be servants of ours. The question is, who's going to rule and who will be subject to whom? And that is really the stakes when Jesus came also. The Philistines had ruled over Israel in measure up to this point and threatened to do so in a more intrusive way if their champion could beat the Israelites' champion. So Satan had ruled over the world prior to the coming of Christ, but Jesus steps forward to challenge him. And the contest between Jesus and Satan, I believe, is the theme of much of the New Testament. We see it in dramatized in Revelation chapter 12, I think. And we see many references to Jesus having conquered Satan, even in the epistles. In Colossians 2:15, it says that Jesus disarmed principalities and powers and made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in the cross. In Hebrews 2:14, it says that Jesus, through death, conquered him or destroyed him that had the power of death, that is the devil. It's Hebrews 2:14. What Jesus accomplished by his death was a conquest over Satan. And I believe there's much in the scripture to indicate that his whole ministry was a conflict which was culminated in his victory at the cross. Now, this victory over Satan was a victory over Satan's kingdom in general. Not only Satan personally, but all those who are under his dominion, all those that are associated with him, now have got to come under the lordship of Jesus. Which is why Jesus at his resurrection could say all authority, we could say kingship or lordship when we say authority, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations and teach them to observe everything I've commanded you, he said. Now, That means that as a result of the death and resurrection of Christ, all authority over all persons has transferred to Christ, some of which had been held by Satan, maybe invalidly, we don't know, but I mean, some of that's a little hard to philosophize through, but the point is, Jesus won the victory and conquered the world. He even said that in his last night with his disciples. He says, in the world you'll have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. I've conquered the world. He conquered the ruler of this world, Satan, and by so doing conquered the whole kingdom that Satan ruled over. Now, David did the same when he conquered Goliath. By conquering the champion of the Philistines, David conquered the Philistines. That was understood. That was in the agreement. Now the Philistines were subject to the Israelites. But what's interesting and relevant to our own lives as Christians is that the Philistines didn't just come along and surrender and say, well, fair enough. Our champion's down. We agreed. We're your servants. Please put the handcuffs on us. Put on the shackles and we'll come home and serve you as household servants and wood water bearers and woodcutters and so forth. No, the Philistines, they had to acknowledge a victory, but they didn't have to acquiesce to it. I mean, they should have, but instead they fled. We see that, of course, in chapter 17 and verse 51. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they ran away. They fled. They didn't surrender. However, there was no question as to who had won. It's not as if it now remained to settle the score and see if the Philistines might really have what it takes to overcome the Jews in battle. That was over. Legally, officially, they had even agreed to it. Their champion's down, they are down. But you got to catch us first, you know. The Philistines were demoralized. They could not fight any longer. They could only run away. But it says in verse 52... that the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shearim, and even as far as Gath and Ekron. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their tents. Now what really happened here is the war was over in a sense, but the Hebrews had to go and mop up. They didn't have to win anything. It was already won. They just had to go take captives. They had to go plunder. They had to go enforce the victory that was already accomplished. And I believe the New Testament speaks in terms of that being our role ever since Christ has won the victory over Satan at the cross. The church is, the enemy is in flight. Remember what James said, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. The devil is defeated. If you don't resist him, he'll have nothing to run away from. But if you resist him, he'll flee. He's the coward. He's demoralized. He has no confidence, no possibility of winning this thing. But he does have the possibility of staying around if no one pursues him. And the Great Commission is nothing else but the command to go out and mop up. Go out and take the captives and plunder the regions that had been held by Satan's power. They are now subject to Christ. They may not know it, and they may not be volunteering, but they are subject to Christ. Their leader has lost, and the gospel of the kingdom that is carried by the missionaries of the church is the message that Christ is now the victor, Christ is now the Lord, Christ is now the King, and that all who hear the message must submit and be taught to observe all things that He commanded. The rule of Christ is therefore imposed by the church's message. We don't impose it with swords and so forth, and neither did Jesus conquer Satan with a sword. You may remember that David, when he confronted Goliath, he said in verse 45, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands." Now, the statement, "the Lord does not save with sword and spear," certainly is not meant to be universal. There certainly were times when God did save with sword and spear. In fact, many of David's mighty men, of which we read later on in 2 Samuel, fought and killed with swords and spears, slew great numbers of people. Sometimes they did it with other implements. David did it with a sling. That's not a sword or a spear, but it's every bit as much a physical weapon as a sword or spear is. But what David is saying is that God doesn't require swords and spears to save. God may, on occasion, choose to save by that means, but in this case, he was not going to. The Goliath had the superior weaponry, and David had what would be regarded as inferior weaponry, although that which could project a rock at the speed of a bullet in those days would seem, to my mind, even better than a sword or a spear. But the point is that David did not beat Goliath by conventional warfare. And this, as a type of Christ, Christ did not beat the devil through force of the type that the devil is accustomed to using against God's people. See, most of what the devil has done against the church over the years is to persecute, to kill, to bring swords, to bring prison bars, to bring racks and instruments of torture. It's been instruments of physical violence that Satan has largely used to try to conquer the church throughout the ages. Jesus has never used such things, nor do his disciples. He wins by other means, but he wins nonetheless. And so this is, I think, the lesson, the spiritual lesson behind David's victory here. Now, frankly, I believe David's victory is to be attributed entirely to supernatural intervention. Just as I said earlier that when David killed a bear and a lion with his bare hands, I believe that that had to be through supernatural strength, even as Samson did, and when the Spirit came upon him. It is, of course, not impossible that a shepherd well skilled with a sling might have struck his mark as well as David did without divine intervention. I mean, depends on how skilled a man is, and I've heard preachers many times talk about how skilled these shepherds become with their slings, quite good at it apparently. But David himself said the Lord is saving here, not David. And while he's not saving with sword and spear, he's not saving with a sling either. It's the battle is the Lord's. It's the Lord who's directing that rock, not the sling or David. It's the Lord who's saving here. And although, of course, in this particular story, a physical victory was accomplished with physical force, a sling is an instrument of force, yet what it symbolizes is Jesus conquering Satan by not the methods of conventional warfare and the pursuit of the Philistines and conquering them, though it was done with instruments of war by the Israelites in this case, I think corresponds to our mission to go out with the sword of the Spirit and to mop up the victory that Christ has won. And wherever the gospel goes, the powers of darkness must recede. If the gospel doesn't go, though, the kingdoms of darkness doesn't just recede automatically. The demons don't just, recoil from the tribal peoples because Jesus 2,000 years ago was saved. I mean, saved us and conquered Satan. But the demons recoil when the missionaries come. They might resist a little bit, but not very. They can't very successfully if the gospel is being preached with the authority of Christ, and history has borne that out. Now, we have this little sequel in verses 55 through 8, and many have found this troublesome. I'll read it and you'll know why. Now, when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son this young man is." Then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Now, I think what's problematic about these verses is fairly obvious. Saul and Abner both profess ignorance of who David is and who his father is. Yet, back in chapter 16, when Saul was perplexed by an evil spirit, he said to his servants around him in verse 17, chapter 16, verse 17, Saul said to his servants, "Provide me now a man who can play well and bring him to me." Then one of the servants answered and said, "Look, I've seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite who is skillful in playing, a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech and handsome person, and the Lord is with him." And so, of course, we read on that David was brought. It says in verse 21 that Saul loved him greatly, and David became his armor-bearer. Now, all this before the conflict with the Philistine. Now, if Saul loved David greatly, had been introduced to him as the son of Jesse, a Bethlehemite, if he had made him his armor-bearer or given him some rank in government, it's hard to imagine how he, at a later date, would be saying, "Who is this guy, anyway? Who is this David? Who is his father? Find out for me, Abner." Now, the solution to this problem has been approached several different ways. Some have suggested that while David had, of course, been a familiar face to Saul, that because of the size of Saul's group of servants and so forth, and how many people Saul dealt with on a daily basis, David was just a court musician who brought in but had never really been introduced to Saul by name. That he came in from time to time, but only when Saul was going crazy with a demon. So Saul was hardly, coherent enough to pay much heed to who it was who was playing the music anyway. David was brought in, as someone to calm him down when he was ranting, and then David would leave when success had come, and Saul had never had opportunity to learn David's name. That is possible, but to my mind, not very likely solution. I mean, if Saul made him his armor bearer or gave him some rank, it's hardly likely that this happened without him being acquainted with David by name, although it is something that some have suggested as a possibility. Another suggestion has been that he may have been asking this question rhetorically of Abner. Whose son is this? Who is this guy anyway? Not so much that he really wanted the information of who is your father, what's your name, but rather that it's more like, wow, what kind of person are we dealing with here? And who is his father? This kind of questioning of a rhetorical nature is found elsewhere in Scripture. For example, in Psalm 8, in this case, the questioning is intended to show the insignificance of the man, not the impressiveness of him. But in Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4, he says, "When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him?" Now, this is just two ways of saying the same thing. What is man? What is the son of man? What is a man and what is his son? The man and his son being considered together only as a method of Hebrew emphasis, What is man? Does he not know what man is? I'm sure that David, who wrote this psalm, knew what a man was and knew what a son of man was. He's speaking it rhetorically, saying, it's a way of emphasizing the relative insignificance of man compared to God, who made the stars and the moon and so forth, that he's been impressed with. But the method of saying it is very Hebrew, very typically Hebrew. And likewise in Proverbs chapter 30, verse 4, Agur, the writer of this chapter, says, "Who has ascended into heaven or descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has bound the waters in a garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name? And what is his son's name, if you know?" Now, I've heard some preachers use this as if to prove that the Old Testament speaks of God having a son, saying that, well, of course, he who has bound the waters in the garment and established the ends of the earth is God. And in saying, who is his name? The answer is Jehovah. And who is his son's name? Suggests that there actually is a son of Jehovah acknowledged in the Old Testament. Because, of course, modern Jews would say the Jehovah of their religion doesn't have any sons. But Christians sometimes point to this verse to prove that he does. But I think the Christians are mistaken in using this verse that way, though I have no objection to saying that God has a son, obviously. But I think that this is rhetorical. He's not asking who is God. He's asking what man is there who has ascended into heaven or descended from heaven? What man could make such claims for himself that he's gathered the wind in his fist or bound the waters in the garment or established the end of the earth? Obviously none. No man could make such a claim. And the writer says, well, if there's a man like that, I'd like to know who he is. I'd like to know who his son is. What's his name? What's his son's name? That, I think, is the import of the passage in Proverbs. And again, it's typical of the Hebrew way of speaking. For Saul to say, who is this young man and who's his father? Sounds very much like the same kind of rhetorical statement. Like, boy, I thought I knew this boy. I thought I knew this musician, but I didn't know him as a giant killer and a warrior. Who is this now? You feel like you've known someone for a long time, and suddenly you feel like you don't know him. It's sort of like when the disciples were in the boat with Jesus and the storm came up. And in fear, they woke him up, and he stilled the storm with a word. And they said, what manner of man is this? And they were greatly afraid. They were well acquainted with Jesus, but suddenly they saw something about him they'd never seen before. And they asked this question, what manner of man is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? Now, they'd seen Jesus do impressive things, but apparently nothing quite so impressive as commanding the weather, and it obeys him instantly. And it sort of made a shiver run through them and made them reassess, do we really know this guy? I thought I knew him, but now I think I didn't know him. I didn't know who he was until now, and now I'm not even sure. And that may be more what's in Saul's mind than anything. I thought I knew this little musician shepherd boy, but who is this, that has been in my presence all day? What is his name? What is his father's name? Now, the one problem with this explanation is that it doesn't just stop with Saul asking the question. Abner actually goes and inquires and brings David to him, and Saul asks him the very question, and David gives an answer, which would seem to indicate this was not just a rhetorical question, but a true request for information. All right? Another possibility is that Saul had just forgotten who his father's name was. And there was a promise, as I recall, that the family of whoever killed Goliath would have tax exemption in Israel. And that Saul wanted to make sure that his family got due credit. And while it may be that back in chapter 16, someone said, we know a son of Jesse in Bethlehem, that now, weeks or months later, Saul didn't remember what family David had come from, didn't remember his father's name. He might have heard it once in passing, but it hadn't stuck. And now that it became incumbent on Saul to grant exemption to the whole family, probably exemption from military service and tax, you know, it would be necessary to ascertain what that family is again. What's your father's name again? And so that is a possible explanation. In fact, I think it might even be the likely one. But there are a couple of others yet. People have wrestled with this for a long time, as you can see, and they've come up with a lot of possible solutions. One is that the whole story, it is thought, might be chronologically related in its wrong place. That the story belongs actually between verses 13 and 14 of chapter 16. Now, I'm not advising this as the correct solution. I'm just saying this has been suggested. If you look at chapter 16, some have thought the story might fit in its entirety between verses 13 and 14, but simply be related later for emphasis or for special notice in chapter 17. In chapter 16, verse 13, it says, "Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward, so Samuel rose and went to Ramah." Verse 14 says, "But the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him." Now, we know that verse 14 is what led to having David come to play music for him. And but in chapter verse 13, David is at his father's house tending sheep, even though he's been anointed by God, and the Spirit comes upon him from time to time. And, of course, in chapter 17, we find David at home tending sheep, and his father sends him out to visit his brothers and all that. So it is thought that perhaps between verses 13 and 14, some period of time could have elapsed, during which time the incursion of the Philistines had caused some of David's brothers to go to war, and his father had sent him out, and this confrontation with Goliath took place. David became the great victor and so forth. But after David was done, he went home again. And then, later on, Saul is afflicted by a demon, and David's reputation as a musician becomes more important, and he comes in as chapter, as the later verses of chapter 16 suggest. Now, this is not without problems, but it could be the correct solution. It may belong there in between those places. Now, one final solution, which is, to my mind, not a good one, is that the Septuagint, the translators of the Septuagint, 285 years before Christ, simply left those verses out at the end of chapter 17. They left it out altogether. If you read the Septuagint, which we have a copy of it back there, 1 Samuel chapter 17, you'll find verses 55 through 58 are not there. Now, some have suggested that this may reflect, let's put it this way, there's textual uncertainty about it. Now, the translators of the Septuagint may have left it out simply because they found it annoying or difficult for the reasons we've been discussing. Or they may have left it out because it wasn't there in the earlier Hebrew copies that they were using, earlier than the ones that we use for our translation. Now, I mean, there's a possibility. Those copies used by the Septuagint translators of the Hebrew text were at least 300 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we are now dependent on for our knowledge of the text. Now, consider that. A text that's 300 years older might bear some differences than the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it is possible that the reason the Septuagint translators left those verses out is because they weren't there in the earlier Hebrew manuscripts, and that somehow they got added after that time to the Hebrew text so that they do appear later in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in the Masoretic text. Our Bible, Old Testament, is translated from the Masoretic text, which contains the verses, but their omission in the Septuagint might argue for their omission in earlier Hebrew copies. So all we can say about it is that there is textual uncertainty about these verses. There's even the possibility that they weren't in the original and that some copyist added them, but we cannot argue that with certainty, and therefore I'd just as soon try to work with the verses present in the passage. And I think it may be possible that Saul was simply trying to ascertain what the family name was that he had to give his exemptions to that he'd promised, or since Saul had very little interest in keeping his promises generally, that might not have been the issue. It might have been simply that this is told in a different chronological place than its actual occurrence, and that its actual occurrence might fall between chapter 16, verse 13, and 16:14. All these are possibilities, some more, some better than others, I suppose. Yes, David?
I was just curious, is an armor bearer, is that like a full-time job?
I think not. As I mentioned, I think, in the last class, that in a military monarchy, people even with minimal government offices, even if they're not military, sometimes are given military rank, just because in a military government, military rank matters. And armor bearer, there might have been a bunch of those. Might have been like a pawn. Might have been like a real, I mean, in a chess game, I think the pawns would be like the armor bearers, you know. And it may have been one of the lowest military ranks that could be given, sort of almost symbolically given out to anyone who held any kind of position in government. Yeah.
So do you think Saul could have had just a slew of armor bearers?
Possibly so, right. Well, see, yeah, there is that possibility. There is that possibility that that armor bearers might have been as numerous as dandelions in a field, you know, I mean, in the government there. Because if it was like a low rank in the political government, you know, the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker in the palace might have all been armor bearers, you know, too, you know, for all anyone knows. And so it may be that there were dozens or scores or hundreds of persons who held that rank. Armor bearer would possibly simply mean that if Saul ever went to battle, these people could be in the position to go before him, carrying his shields and armor and so forth. In other words, they go out vulnerable ahead of him. They're dispensable. I don't know, and no one knows for sure, because we have such scant record of the period. In fact, all we have is here in the Bible, and obviously from what we have, we could assume one or another understanding of it, but we couldn't be sure that we were right. Okay, let's move along then. So far, David's a hero, but things change. I mean, he remains a hero to the people, but Saul gets upset with him here pretty soon. And it was so, chapter 18, when he had finished speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Jonathan is a noble person in the story. We don't really read anything bad about Jonathan. He doesn't always do perhaps the most godly thing. It's hard to say. We will be disappointed perhaps with Jonathan later because he doesn't go with David when David has to run for his life. And Jonathan could conceivably have done so to help him, but he doesn't. But Jonathan probably had what he thought were good reasons and godly reasons for doing what he did. Also, we find Jonathan willing to lie for David. And the whole issue of lying in the Old Testament, where the lie is not harmful to anybody and is maybe even necessary to protect somebody, is treated with, let's just put it away. We Christians can often be uncomfortable with the way that the Old Testament treats the whole issue of lying under certain circumstances. Rahab lies about the spies being with her. For this she is not censured. Of course, nobody is harmed by her lies. She's not bearing false witness against a neighbor or anything like that so that somebody's harmed by it, and therefore she doesn't end up violating the command in the Decalogue about that. But at the same time, Christian ethics, generally speaking, forbid lying under any circumstances, and there are many Christians who be very firm on this, regardless, even if you're lying to save somebody's life. There are Christians, thinkers that I've encountered, Richard Wurmbrandt being one of them, some of the brothers from the underground churches in communist countries, have felt that misleading the government in order to save persons' lives or to advance the cause of the kingdom of God, they have felt may be justifiable at times. Now, this is a repugnant idea to many Christians, and it's hard to know It's not as simple as one might think. You can find many verses in the Bible that forbid lying, but one would have to decide what is the context and what is meant by lying here. Is David lying when he pretends to be mad so that he's not killed by the Philistines? Well, he's kind of lying by his behavior. Is Samuel lying when he says he's going to Bethlehem to offer a sacrifice when he's really going there to anoint another king? Well, no, but it's not entirely the whole truth he's telling either. I mean, even in John chapter 7, where Jesus' brothers say, why don't you go down to Jerusalem? And he says, I'm not going to this feast. And then after they're gone, he goes down secretly. Some manuscripts have him saying, I'm not going yet to this feast, although he might have implied, I'm not going right now, even if he didn't say yet. He did go later, but secretly. Was this deceptive on his part? I certainly would never accuse Jesus of lying. But I guess what I'm considering here is that, and what, we haven't even come to one of the instances yet, but we shall soon. We read a lot of strategic misleading. Let's put it that way. Now, I'm not saying this isn't lying. It may well be lying. It may be well condemned in Scripture. But the Bible doesn't editorialize all the time about it. A lot of times it may be very much like polygamy. The Bible doesn't editorialize about polygamy either, but every time that someone does it, it's demonstrated to be disastrous. And that's generally the case, not always, but generally the case with David lying, for example. He lies a number of times and fakes things, but some would argue that it always turned out badly for him when he did, or for someone. I'm not sure that could be sustained, but the point is that some feel that the only thing that God forbids about lying is when somebody is hurt by it. After all, the heart and soul of Christian and godly ethics is love your neighbor as yourself and love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and that such things are offensive to God as are unloving to your neighbor. And generally speaking, when people are liars, they do so to take advantage of somebody, to gain from somebody dishonestly or some other thing. I mean, virtually all lying is selfish and injurious to somebody. Depriving people of the truth, in most cases, is done so that that person who's deprived of the truth might be taken advantage of in some way. And some Christian authors have argued that that kind of lying is always wrong. But they would say to mislead in some way by action or word when nobody is going to be victimized and when, in fact, they say it is necessary to do so for the sake of saving a life or whatever. Some would say, well, this is not offensive to God in the way that most lying is. Now, I'm not saying this is true. I'm saying that you will meet Christian writers who say that, Richard Wurmbrand being one. Another that's recently come out is a fellow who publishes a Christian magazine called Media Spotlight. He recently, in an issue, indicated that he felt that lying under certain circumstances have biblical precedent and so forth. Now, this may seem strange to our ears, and I'm not saying you have to accept it. I'm not sure I accept it. I'm saying that there is tremendous room for exploration and discussion about the whole ethics of truth-telling. Brother Andrew, for example, God's smuggler, says he would never lie. If the border guards ask him if he's bringing Bibles in, he'll say yes, because he cannot bring himself to lie. On the other hand, he may have his Bibles hidden under the seat of the car or in his suitcase under his clothing, hoping that if they look, they won't know there's Bibles there. Well, is he covering up the truth by putting clothing over his Bibles so they can't see them? Is this a lie? I mean, how do we, you know, there's this continuum, this moral continuum. I hate to sound like a situation ethicist, and that's maybe what I sound like, because I'm not supporting this. I'm saying, trying to say this is more complex than some may think. That on one end of the continuum is telling the whole truth, everything you know in every situation, concealing nothing. At the other end is telling total fabrications and lies at the other end of the continuation. And somewhere in between you've got things like telling part of the truth but not all of it, or somewhere in the middle is saying nothing, saying neither the truth nor a lie, and further down the line is, you know, telling what some might refer to as a white lie or something like that, but not a whole lie, a half-truth, you know, And the question is, I guess, at what point, short of telling everything you know to everybody who wants to know, as you move down that line toward lying, at what point does it become sinful deception? Are we obligated to tell people everything we know? Of course not. But what measures are legitimate for concealing things that ought to be concealed? See, Brother Andrew argues that while he would never tell a lie, he also doesn't believe he has to disclose to the border guards, even though it's a matter of the law of that land that you can't bring them in. And even though he is definitely, they would disapprove if they knew, and he is definitely trying to sneak something by them, he feels, and he says it's because they have no right to know. They are opposed to the kingdom of God. He's obeying the command of God to take the gospel to every nation. He is under a commission from his king. And in, he says in war, you just don't let people know everything that they might want to know. You know, it's a matter of intrigue. It's a matter of concealment. Now, he doesn't take that so far as to lie, but he considers that at wartime, you simply don't tell your enemy everything you know and everything that they'd like to know. So I guess a person has to decide where the ethical line is drawn. I hope I don't sound like the rowboat people, the lifeboat people, who say, well, who do you throw out of the lifeboat? You know, that's this kind of, what's it called, situation ethics or whatever, is something I don't approve of. But I do believe that we find in David and Jonathan both the willingness to tell something that's not true, not to anyone's hurt, but in their mind, to someone's good. For example, David lies to the high priest when he comes and eats the showbread. He may feel like he's protecting the high priest by lying to him, because if he told the priest, listen, I'm running from Saul, help me out, and the priest helped him, then Saul could rightly say, you deliberately helped David in rebellion to me. Whereas if David said, no, I'm on a king's errand, then the priest could honestly say, David didn't tell me he was on anything but a king's errand. I didn't know I was helping a rebel, And this would then protect the priest. That may be what David intended. But all I'm going to say is, in this story where we see a great deal of intrigue and misinformation, even Michael lying that David is sick and can't come out so that he can have a chance to escape, this is not very much different than Rahab lying about the spies. And it's hard to know. Some people think Rahab was justified in it. Others say no. She's never commended for lying. She's commended for her faith in the Bible. She's not commended for lying. Yet nothing is ever said negatively about Rahab. Whenever she is remembered, she's remembered positively, and the principal thing she did was lie to protect the innocent. So this is a subject, I think, Christian ethicists and ethical thinkers, which is what you are. I'm not talking about academics. I'm talking about every Christian who cares about right and wrong needs to really do some prayerful searching of Scripture and so forth to reach his own conclusions, because it is conceivable that we may find ourselves living under a government system that forbids, for example, meetings of Christians, where meetings have to be held secretly or not at all, or where they want to get information about you or your children that you don't feel they have any right to and that you don't think would be in the interest of the kingdom of God to give them. We have been blissfully free from having to consider these things, because we've never really been in danger. David, when in danger. Rahab, when the spies were in danger. Richard. Underground church was in danger. And others have apparently at times felt that lying was right, or at least justifiable. Maybe not right entirely. Maybe it's not desirable, but they felt they could justify it by appeal to extenuating circumstances. And what's interesting is that David, at a later time in Chronicles, is eulogized as being perfect before the Lord in all matters except for his sin with Bathsheba, which is strange, because we find a lot of imperfection in David, a lot of things that we can't imagine Jesus doing or even that Christians shouldn't do, it would seem. Yet his heart apparently was right before the Lord in it, and I leave it to you to make the moral decisions or ethical pronouncements and editorializations on David and Jonathan and some of these and Michael, and as they do use falsehood as a means of saving David's life. Now, let me just say, it may sound like I've just said a lot of things in favor of their line. I don't want to give that impression. The reason I've said so much about it is because I assume most of us, myself included, inclined to the view that it's always wrong to lie. Therefore, I figure that if the other view is going to even receive the slightest consideration, there has to be a strong case made to give it consideration. But I want to say this, that those who would say, no, it's never right to lie, could say, well, everything Rahab, Michael, David, Jonathan did in this respect exhibits a lack of faith. Just like when Abraham lied and said that Sarah was his sister. It was a lack of faith on his part. And had David trusted God, he could have told the truth and God would have supernaturally protected him. It may be true that the conventional wisdom was that if you don't lie, you're going to have your head rolling. But on at the same time, conventional wisdom doesn't necessarily is not always able to predict what God may do. And so it could be argued that had Rahab told the truth, somehow God could have intervened to save those spies. And likewise, David could have been spared, since there was a destiny for David that had not yet been fulfilled. He should have maybe trusted God, that if he told the truth all the time, God would somehow spare him. So those are the two sides of the issue. We read on now. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. Now, that is following up on the fact that there were times when David was allowed to go home prior to this, but he was only needed prior to this when Saul's fit was upon him. But now David was going to be a valuable military person, and his military rank was not going to be in name only. He was actually going to lead armies. This was not in the capacity of an armor bearer. He apparently received a higher rank in the army after this. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword. And there were only two of those in Israel. Well, there are probably more now since they conquered the Philistines. They could take swords. And his bow and his belt. At one time, Jonathan's sword was the only sword that he had, or one of two in the nation. And to give it to David was very symbolic of giving up his position as the prince. He was recognizing very much earlier than most people did that David was really legitimately the next heir to the throne. And for Jonathan, who was in fact the heir to the throne, to do this suggests tremendous humility on his part and willingness to just surrender his position to the one that God had anointed. Though he probably did not know, but he may have. I mean, they're good friends. David may have told him, you know, Samuel anointed me at my dad's house and it blew all of our minds, but we don't know what it means. And Jonathan may have said, I know what it means. You're going to be the next king. Here, take my sword, take my bow. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war. And he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also the sight of Saul's servants. Now it happened as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? Now, Saul eyed David from that day forward, eyed him with suspicion, that is. He kept his eye on him, thinking that if he did not, David might try something and to exploit the popularity that he now enjoyed and to take the kingdom from him. Now, of course, David had no such designs, and Saul was simply paranoid. But it was, in fact, the women who sang this song probably in no way meant to depreciate Saul's achievements. They probably felt like, well, to say Saul has slain his thousands is to affirm him. He's a wonderful guy. He's a great leader, a great military man. And isn't it wonderful that God has sent along even a younger guy who slaughter even more? Not in any sense implying that they wanted to make David the king, but just rejoicing in God's providence of two great leaders who could destroy so many of their enemies and deliver them. But Saul saw it more as a threat to his throne, obviously. And it happened on the next day, verse 10, that a distressing spirit from God came upon him. And he prophesied inside the house. Now, prophesied here, it's hard to know what is meant. Remember that even false prophets in the Bible are said to prophesy. Prophesying and prophets aren't always a reference to genuine prophecy from God. It can be demonic. It can be something else. He may have been ranting. He may have been, you know, when you speak under the influence of a spirit, it is possible that this is simply called prophesying in the Old Testament. And the spirit that he's speaking by was an evil spirit. So he may have just been ranting under the influence of this demonic power on him. So David played music with his hand, as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, I will pin David to the wall with it. But David escaped his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000, And he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. So here we found three times people have been said to love David. We found back in chapter 16, verse 21, Saul loved him greatly. However, Saul's love for David was conditional. He loved David as long as David's music calmed his nerves, settled his restless spirit. As long as the demons that were tormenting him were driven away by David's music, he loved that. But as soon as he began to suspect that David might be the king in his place, he didn't love that. His love for David was short-lived because it was conditioned upon David pleasing him. It did not go so far as to love him enough to surrender the throne to him, even if it was God's will for Saul to do so. In this respect, as I pointed out on other occasions, Saul is a picture of many people who would call themselves Christians. Jesus is a name that is sweet to their ears. In times of great trial and fearfulness, to pray or to cry out to Jesus or to hear a sermon or to read the words of Jesus, some of the words of Jesus, not all of them are comforting, but some people find some comfort. And at those times, they're really fond of Jesus. But they'd never dream of replacing him onto the throne of their heart instead of themselves. And when Jesus begins to make such claims and they begin to feel those claims, they often become actually more hostile toward Christianity than positively inclined toward it. Thus, such was Saul's love for David. In chapter 18, we read that Jonathan loved David. In verse 1, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Now, here's a man who loved David more than his father did. His father loved David briefly and conditionally. Jonathan was willing actually to surrender his throne. He gave David all the trappings of his own authority, and there could be little implied more than that Jonathan was acknowledging David to be the next king. In fact, later on, Jonathan actually acknowledges this verbally. Over in chapter 23, verse 17, Jonathan says to David, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that." Now, Jonathan predicted wrongly that he would be next to David, but it's interesting. He said, "You will be the king over Israel." At this point, Jonathan was in good health, in good standing in the kingdom, and David was a refugee out in the woods, hiding out. And yet Jonathan knew David was the one that God had chosen. He acknowledged it verbally and by his actions. So the love of Jonathan for David was much more like a Christian's love for Jesus ought to be, willing to surrender our own sovereignty over our lives to him, because it is recognized that that's what God desires. Now, we read here later on in verse 16 of chapter 18 that all of Israel and Judah loved David. Now, their love for David was mixed. There were some who stayed loyal to Saul until he died and then chose David to be the king. There were others who went with David, as we shall see a little later, when David fled from Saul. There's 400, a number that later grew to 600, that fled with him and suffered with him and hid out with him and endangered their lives to be associated with him when Saul was against them. And here we see, I think, very much the picture of the two kinds of persons that call themselves Christians today. All profess to love Jesus, but some remain loyal to Saul, the king of this world. Remember, Saul's name means asked for. Saul was what the people wanted. Worldly rulers, the worldly kingdoms, the things of this world is what people by nature in their flesh want, what they choose for themselves. Some of them may recognize that someday Jesus will take over here, and they want to be part of that too. They'll accept his kingdom when he comes, but until then, they just as soon not rock the boat. They'll still do things according to the worldly way. They'll still enjoy the things of the world and Jesus too. And they hope that they may someday reign with him. Well, I don't think that they will be able to do so. But there are persons, like the 400, later the 600, who actually, though Saul was still technically reigning, they recognized that David was God's anointed ruler, and they followed him. They lived dangerously with him. They lived uncomfortably with him. They forsook what they had had under Saul's kingdom in order to be loyal to David. We read of this later on, of course. We read of them in chapter 22, verse 2. We're told there that there were 400 of them. And just a little later, their number swells to 600 in chapter 23, verse 13. So we have all these different people who love David in different ways. And likewise, there are those who could be said to love Jesus in different ways. But only the ones who fled with him, those who lived in caves and dens of the earth, who endangered their lives, gave up their positions in the world, as it were, when he came to power, they reigned with him. They became his cabinet, his officials, and so forth. They shared in his glory because they shared in his humiliation and his suffering. And so the New Testament indicates that that's how it is with Christ. There's a lot of Christians who will verbally acknowledge that Jesus someday will be their king. But later, when he comes back, and sets up his kingdom, then we'll be very glad to submit to him in all things and rejoice in his coming and so forth. But in the meantime, since he doesn't seem to be winning at the moment, his cause seems to be rather unpopular. And the real prosperity and the real comforts and the real popularity and so forth are to be found in Saul's domain. They just soon remain in Saul's domain for the time being. And they hope to have all this in heaven too. Well, that is a picture that we see throughout the story of David here. Then verse 17. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merib. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." Now, Saul wanted to kill David, but he didn't. He felt like that would be a sticky situation. If he killed David, how's he going to justify that to the people who love David? I mean, how's he going to convince anybody that David deserved to die? I mean, Saul's going to look like the arch criminal, which he was. He thought, I'll just keep him out in the battlefront. Someday the Philistines will take him down. So David said to Saul, "Who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king?" Now, when he killed Goliath, the agreement was that whoever killed Goliath would become the king's son-in-law. David killed Goliath, but apparently he made no move to claim that privilege of being son-in-law. He may be speaking with real humility, or maybe just sort of a humility that politeness would require, to say, "Well, I don't think I'm worthy to be the king's son-in-law." In any case, he didn't make any moves in the direction of claiming her. But it happened at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, as wife. Now, we read nothing of why this happened. It's a mystery why. You know, what transpired, we realize this is real people, real things really happened. Something transpired about the time that David would have married her. She was given to somebody else. How this transpired is totally undisclosed, but it certainly is obviously an injustice against David. Now, Michal, Saul's daughter, must be his younger daughter, loved David. There's another one who loves him. He's a lovable guy. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, "I will give her to him, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, "You shall be my son-in-law today." Now, it's hard to know exactly how Saul was thinking. "I'll give her to him that she might be a snare to him, and the hand of the Philistines be against him." Perhaps he thought his daughter would remain loyal to the father, and that he could use her to find, you know, a vulnerable moment to get rid of David. Yeah, okay, if David marries her, a man's vulnerable to nobody so much as to his wife. She's around him when he's asleep. If she has his confidence, she can mislead him or whatever. She can do all kinds of things to lead him into a trap. Saul suspected that his daughter would side with him against her husband. Turned out wrong. She sided with David against Saul when it really came down to it. But Saul felt that by giving Michal to David would be something that would entrap David in some way. Now, it's not clear exactly why the hand of the Philistines would be against David in a case like that. Perhaps because by elevating David to the status of the king's son-in-law, the Philistines might make him more of a target in battle. Saul was apparently not going out to battle anymore. In ancient times, sometimes kings actually led their troops to battle, but when they did, they were extremely targeted by the enemy, because to kill the king was the way to defeat the nation. And so it was risky for royalty to go out to war. Sometimes they did it anyway. Well, David at this point was not royalty, but by making him royalty and yet having him go out to war, it'd make him specially targeted by the Philistines, and that may be what Saul had in mind. Maybe they'd want to take out this royal personage more than just another commander of the armies. So he approached David and said, "You'll be my son-in-law, David." And Saul commanded his servants, "Communicate with David secretly and say, 'Look, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law.'" So Saul's servants spoke those words in the hearing of David. And David said, "Does it seem to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law, seeing I'm a poor man and lightly esteemed?" Now, he felt himself unworthy to be even the son-in-law of a king. How ironic this is, when in fact God had chosen him to be the king himself. But it just shows that the man that thinks low of himself, God thinks more highly of. And when Saul was little in his own eyes, is when God chose him to be king. David was truly little in his own eyes. Not only did he, knowing that he was anointed to be the next king, he nonetheless felt unworthy even to be the son-in-law of the king, much less the king. But he said, "I'm a poor and lightly esteemed man." Now, the poor part is apparently the issue that Saul felt he had to address, because ordinarily you have to give a dowry. If you if you're going to marry the virgin daughter of a man, you have to give the man a bride price. And what kind of, how could a poor man pay a dowry or bride price to a king? What could he afford that wouldn't be insultingly small? So this is what Saul next addresses. The servants of Saul told him, saying, "In this manner David spoke." Then Saul said, "Thus you shall say to David, 'The king does not desire any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies.'" I think you have to kill him to get him. It'd be a real trick to get him without killing him. "But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines." In other words, David had probably gone out and slain more than 100 Philistines before, but not alone. He'd gone at the head of 1,000 men. He was the commander of 1,000 soldiers. He'd probably killed thousands of Philistines, but this was, you got to do it alone, on your own. You've got to go personally and kill 100 Philistines, get their foreskins, and bring them in. Now, Saul simply thought that's more than even David could accomplish. David might be able to kill a giant, but 100 men? Hardly likely. Although he should remember that Jonathan alone had killed 20 Philistines with his armor bearer, and David had done supernatural things, so he should have suspected that David might just pull it off. But Saul was, of course, setting this as the dowry with a mind to trap David and make him fall at the hands of the Philistines. So when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to become the king's son-in-law. Now the days had not expired, therefore David arose and went, he and his men, and killed 200 men. Now, his men can't mean the 1,000, because that would hardly be an accomplishment, 1,000 men going against 100. Actually, it turned out to be 200, but that's still no great exploit. So his men might simply be armor bearers that attended him, or, you know, others who went to watch or something, but certainly there'd be no great exploit if David took his troops out, 1,000 men who were under his command and killed. So I'm under the impression David did this single-handedly. Those men, some of his men were there. And he killed 200 men of the Philistines, and David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full count to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as a wife. And we think the Indians were barbaric for scalping people, their victims. Actually, Saul was apparently more barbaric. And scalping is bad enough. This is, to my mind, even more grotesque. Thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, and Saul was still more afraid of David, so Saul became David's enemy continually. Now, Saul, I believe, represents the world system in this analogy. If David represents Christ. And remember, David was the anointed king, but he didn't hold official power yet as king. He was not recognized as king by anyone except Jonathan at this point. And therefore, although he was God's choice of king, and that choice had been made known through the anointing of Samuel, it was going to be months or years, we don't know how long exactly, before David ever really became the sitting king. And this, I believe, represents the period from the time that Jesus came and was declared king, by God, really, by his resurrection from the dead and by the anointing of the Holy Spirit, from that time to the time Jesus actually comes back and becomes the sitting, visible, universal, undisputed king. The period of David's obscurity, and it wasn't all obscurity, he was pretty famous some of that time as a warrior, but the time from his anointing to the death of Saul and David actually becoming king, I believe represents the age that we live in, the age of the church, from the time that Jesus came and was anointed and the time that he actually comes back and rules universally over all. And some of that time, by the way, is interesting. Some of that period of David's life was times of great victory and success and popularity, but another part was of persecution and flight, especially the latter part. And that may be true, and has been true, of the church at various times in its history. Sometimes the church has enjoyed great ascendancy, great glory, great prestige, great favor in the world. Other times, not so great. Sometimes persecuted severely and in flight, running from here and there just to stay in existence. And David's career, I think, represents that of the church throughout the whole church age. But what's interesting here is that Saul, the more he saw the blessing of God on David, the more afraid he became. Now, this fear of David didn't make Saul persecute him less, but more. And I think that as the gospel advances in the world today, and it is, that the world system, out of fear of the advance and progress of the gospel, will persecute it more hotly. Certainly that has happened in China. The gospel has spread. The church has grown rapidly there. And once it looked like, well, maybe, you know, the gospel, who knows, if it keeps going like this, a few more decades, everyone in China is going to be saved. That'll be the end of communist China. But the communist government has not failed to observe this phenomenon either, and they have been cracking down lately on the house churches and so forth much more severely than they had been for a while. So it's just the tendency of the world, like Saul, to become fearful when they see the success of David. To increase and take harsher steps of persecution. Then the princes of the Philistines went out to war, verse 30. And so it was, whenever they went out, that David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. Moving along, chapter 19. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. Now, Saul had tried this a couple times. Then he tried it through intrigues and plots. Nothing seemed to work. So now he speaks openly to his servants, even to Jonathan, and says, listen, we've got to kill David. Well, obviously, this is the first time he's spoken plainly about it. And Jonathan told David, because it says, Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, my father, Saul, seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe I will tell you. Now Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father, and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good towards you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause? So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan for the moment. And Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. Now, Saul's oaths are about worth as much as the bad breath that he expelled in speaking them. There's not really much to them. He says, as Jehovah lives, he's swearing by Jehovah, but he might as well have said nothing or said the opposite, because he doesn't keep his oaths at all. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. So Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in past times. He had a brief reprieve, because Saul was still somewhat influenced by a bit of conscience. When he made an oath, he'd keep it briefly. Then he'd stop keeping it when the urge hit him. And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. Now, the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with a spear in his hand, and David was playing music with his hand. Then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with his spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michal let David down through a window, sort of like Paul escaping out a window in a basket, and also the spies in Jericho. Must have been a typical way when people had an apartment on the wall there so he could get out of the city that way. And he went and fled and escaped. And Michael took an image and laid it in the bed to cover put a cover of goat's hair on his head and covered it with clothes. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Apparently they came to look and saw there was something in the bed there and figured it was David, so they took her word for it. Then Saul sent the messengers back. And when the messengers had come in, there was the image. We missed something here. Then Saul sent the messengers back, verse 15, to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him." So he was making no secret of his plans. Now, by the way, you got to realize that his servants, this was out in the open now, his servants and much of the citizenry must have been aware that Saul was persecuting David. And while they could hardly approve of it, no one really stood up to him. Jonathan spoke up in David's favor, but no one really seriously stood up to Saul. But they certainly must have been in their hearts thought, this guy's gone nuts. I mean, the popular support for Saul must have been half-hearted at best. He was losing prestige in the eyes of his people all the time, and we'll see evidence of that later on. And it says, then Saul said, they said, "Bring him in his bed that I may kill him." And when the messengers had come in, there was the image in bed with a cover of goat's hair for its head. Then Saul said to Michael, "Why have you deceived me like this and sent away my enemy so that he has escaped?" And Michael answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" So she not only lied, saying that David was sick, which he was not. That was to save David's life. But then she lied to save her own life. If she had said, "Well, so, Dad, because you're just wrong. You're just wrong. I can't go along with you on this. You're trying to kill David and he's done nothing wrong. You're just a wicked man. And I had to resist you in this. I had to oppose you in this." That would have at least been honest. She may have been thrown in jail or killed if her dad was under a fit of demonic anger at the moment. But it would have been telling the truth and it would have been standing up valiantly for what's right. But instead she saved her own skin by misleading him, saying that David threatened her life. Now, of course, this wouldn't wash because since David was already gone from the house by the time the servants came, he was in no position to kill her if she didn't lie. And she could have told the truth at that point and been under protection. But in any case, David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah. Now, before we read of his time with Samuel, we're running low on time, but I want to turn your attention to Psalm 59. There are quite a large number of psalms, most of them in the 50s range, that were written during David's time of persecution from Saul. These would include Psalm 52, Psalm 54, Psalm 56, 57, and 59. Now, there are some other psalms besides those, but those ones all fall in the range of the 50s. It's Psalm 59. They're not, by the way, arranged in chronological order, but Psalm 59 has this title given to it: "To the chief musician, set to Do Not Destroy," apparently a tune that was well known. "A Mishtam of David, when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him." So this is a psalm that David wrote apparently concerning the stakeout at his place that we just read about. Now, he may not have read it while they were staking him out. He might have escaped first and then wrote the psalm in retrospect about the event. But it's even possible that he wrote at the time. David may have been one who tended to write out his prayers. And if he was surrounded at that moment, even in his house, he may well have prayed. Who wouldn't? And if he prayed, he may have written out his prayer, and this could be written at that very time. I have not known very many people who write out their prayers, though I did know one minister who did, and when I told him I thought that was interesting, he thought it strange that I'd never encountered anyone else who did. I don't think I've ever met anyone else who writes out their prayers, but he would just sit and he'd write out his prayers to God. I mean, he'd be praying it as he wrote. I'm not aware of that being a very common thing for people to do. I guess some people who journal might do that. You do that too. That's, to my mind, a biblical thing to do. I think David may well have written his psalms in that manner. But I don't think it's all that common. I don't know that very many Christians would do it, but it certainly sounds like a good thing to do. Anyway, as you can see, we won't read the whole Psalm 59, but it was written on that occasion, and it opens like this: "Deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity and save me from bloodthirsty men." Given the stated circumstance of its writing, we know who those bloodthirsty men are, especially Saul. "For look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather against me. not for my transgression nor for my sin, O Lord. They run and prepare themselves through no fault of mine. Awake to help me, and behold, you therefore, O Lord, God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to punish all the nations. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressors. Now, at the end of this psalm, he's got more of an upbeat note. In verses 16 and 17, he says, "But I will sing of your power. Yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning. For you have been my defense and refuge in the day of my trouble. To you, O my strength, I will sing praises. For God is my defense, the God of my mercy." So he's, many of his psalms start out that way, in despair, but end in victory. I think he prays through to victory is what happens. I think he prays when he's in trouble, and he prays until he feels like he's not in trouble anymore, until he's got the assurance from God that God's got things in hand. But this was written and prayed, apparently, at the time that we just read about, when they were staking out his house, trying to capture him to kill him. Verse 18, back to chapter 19, verse 18. "So David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth." Now, Naoth in Hebrew means the dwellings. And most scholars believe that Naoth was not another town that he went into besides Ramah, but it was a compound within Ramah where the prophets lived, perhaps a community of prophets, a particular compound of dwellings of the prophets. And so they went in there to be a little bit more sequestered and a little more protected. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. And when Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. Then Saul sent messengers again, the third time, and they prophesied also. Then he also went to Ramah and came to the great well that is at Sechu. So he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And someone said, "Indeed, they are at Naoth in Ramah." So he went there to Naoth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramah. Apparently, as he approached, he came under the influence of the Spirit briefly and was prophesying as he walked, as he proceeded. And he also stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets, that he stripped himself naked and lay down. The laying down part is often thought to be a reference to being slain in the Spirit, a phenomenon that Pentecostals often, is very familiar and common among Pentecostal people. It may well be that that's the correct way of understanding it. It does not say that he lay down because he was forcibly made to lay down under the power of the Spirit, but that may well be the case. Much about what he did is not easily explained. Taking off his clothes, for example, it's not clear why he did that, nor is it clear why he laid down. But the fact that it says he was naked, many scholars are a bit squeamish about that, and they suggest that what it means is he took off his upper garments or his outer garments or his kingly robe. He still had something on, but he basically divested himself of his robes. Now, this may suggest that he was thrashing around. It may suggest that he was raving. We don't know exactly what was going on. All we know was that the Holy Spirit demonstrated his own ability to protect David. And this in itself may be the best argument against David resorting to ruses and lies to protect himself. I mean, it's like when Jesus was apprehended in the garden and he said, "I am," and all those who came to take him fell over backward. Now, why did he do that? Why did he knock them over backward when, in fact, they got back to their feet and took him away? I think he did that in order to show that if he didn't want them to, they couldn't take him away. That all he'd have to do is speak a word and they'd keep falling over. He could do that as often as he wanted to. And by allowing himself to be taken, he was not overwhelmed. He was surrendering himself, and he demonstrated that in a way that would be maybe less clear. That would otherwise be less clear, by knocking him down with a word and showing that, you know, that's what he has at his disposal, but now he's not going to use it anymore. He's going to let them take him. He said elsewhere, "No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord." And that's what he was demonstrating, that they couldn't take him if he didn't let them. And this situation where the Spirit knocks Saul and his messengers down, and they're totally under the influence of the Spirit, even though they're wicked men, is God's way, I think, of saying, you see, if I don't want them to, David, they can't get you. I can stop them. I've got resources of my own available. And David may not have, the lesson may have been lost on David. David may have been just so terrified. I mean, I don't know how many times you need to have spears hit the wall, you know, 2 inches from your nose before you get real nervous and decide that running away is the best course of action in any case. So verse chapter 20, David fled from Naoth in Ramah, and he went and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" Now, Jonathan wasn't even aware of all this. It was concealed from him. Jonathan said to him, "By no means. You shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Then David took an oath again and said, "Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives, as the soul of as your soul lives, there's but a step between me and death." So Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you." And David said to Jonathan, "Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon." That's the first day of every month was the new moon. It was a celebration for the Jews. "And I should not fail to sit with the king to eat," because he was part of the king's cabinet. He should be there at the meal for the feast. "But let me go that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked permission to me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family.'" Now, this is a lie. Okay, but Jonathan told it anyway. "If he says thus, 'It is well,' your servant will be safe." That is, if Saul doesn't mind that, it indicates that Saul is not really actively seeking David. "But if he is very angry, then be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father?" If I deserve to die, go ahead and kill me, but don't take me to your father for him to do it. "And Jonathan said, 'Far be it from you. For if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you?' Then David said to Jonathan, 'Who will tell me? Or what if your father answers you roughly?' And Jonathan said to David, 'Come and let us go out into the field.' So both of them went out into the field. Then Jonathan said to David, 'The Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away that you may go in safety. And the Lord be with you as he has been with my father.'" Now, why did David need this information? Didn't David already know that Saul was killing him? Why is he asking for this information about how Saul reacts to find out if Saul's angry or not? I personally think that David had no reason to doubt at all that Saul was angry. He's staking out his house trying to kill him. He hurled javelins at him. I think what David wanted is for Jonathan to realize that David was not paranoid, not doing some weird thing. David was about to flee. And if Jonathan didn't know that there was active plots on his life, Jonathan might misunderstand David's doing it, might think he's making much of nothing and so forth. So I think this whole thing that David suggested here, see how your father reacts when you tell him that I've gone to a feast, that was there for Jonathan's sake. So that, I mean, David knew he was going to have to flee anyway. But David wanted Jonathan to be sympathetic with him and know that this was not something he was doing unnecessarily so that it wouldn't be misunderstood. Now, it says in verse 14, Jonathan said to David, "And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." Now, what he's saying is, I know, David, you're going to be the ruler. And typically, rulers of new dynasties wipe out everyone from the previous dynasty. But since I'm your friend, please swear to me now that you won't wipe me out or my offspring. And sure enough, David didn't have to wipe out Jonathan and wouldn't have, but Jonathan was killed in battle with Saul before David came to power. And Mephibosheth was an offspring of Jonathan, and David gave him special honor rather than exterminate him like most kings would do of the previous dynasty. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." And Jonathan again caused David to vow, because he loved him, and he loved him as his, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you'll be missed because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed, and remain by the stone easel. Then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it, as though I shot at a target. And there I will send a lad, saying, go find the arrows. If I expressly say to the lad, look, the arrows are on this side of you, then get them and come. Then as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm. But if I say thus to the young man, look, the arrows are beyond you. Go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed the Lord be between you and me forever. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. But Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely he's unclean. A lot of things could make a guy unclean accidentally, and he couldn't come to the feast in that case. But he'd normally be clean the next day. And it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat either yesterday or today? So Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked permission to go of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know? Now, he did have a parent that was perverse, but it wasn't his mother. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? And Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father treated him.